The first time I remember, I actually, when I raced Badlands, I was unsure of how to deal with the culture difference. And not like it's huge, but it was definitely a learning curve for me racing in another country. And now I've raced in Chile and Colombia and the US and France and Italy and Spain. So now I know how to deal with it. I know how to just kind of roll with the punches. I always say practice makes prepared. So, you know, each race is a practice and being more prepared for the next one.
It's showtime, everybody! Showtime!
You've been living in a dream world, Neo. Yeah. This is the world as it exists today.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while. You could miss it.
Listen, we're talking about practice.
Hey, Pete, on the dude's rug.
Donnie, you're out of your element.
I see. You think this has nothing to do with you.
Don't ever trash talk Black Jesus.
This is the Adventure Stash with Payson McKelvin.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the show. Today is our first episode recorded from Bentonville, Arkansas, which is going to be our home base for the spring. Kind of trying something new this year with preparation. I've noticed over the last few years that for me, there's such a thing as too much time at altitude, especially when preparing for sea level races. So we're seeking out that nice thick oxygen, some warm, humid air to prepare for Unbound and the other spring goals before making our migration back to the mountains of Durango. But in the meantime, you can enjoy some episodes recorded from Bentonville, Northwest Arkansas. Currently seeking out a studio here to use, but made the most of the home setup this time. Although you may notice that there's a little bit of static in some of the background of the audio now and then. I think either Cynthia or I put our cell phone down next to one of the mic cables, which can interfere with it a little bit. So our bad on that, but I don't think it's too bad. This conversation should more than carry itself otherwise. Cynthia is one of the top ultra endurance racers in the world now. She's won Badlands, won Atlas already this spring. Also happens to be coached by my coach, Dennis Van Winden of the Orange Seal Academy. Orange Seal is her title sponsor. It's fun to talk a little bit about that and her diving headlong into having a real career as an ultra racer, along with someone that's just making a difference in the sport across the board, including hosting her own event. I don't think I've ever recorded one of these things with a bike pack racer or ultra racer and not had it be wildly interesting. So please sit back and enjoy. But first, couple super quick announcements I wanted to make you aware of. I'm actually about to leave to the airport to pick her up. She's on her way back from Uganda. And we're going to record a podcast. It'll be the first time since she and I have recorded a podcast in years and years. But she's been up to so much with her Path of Logic charity over in Equatorial Africa that I thought it was high time. And I finally convinced her to come on the show again. So if you have questions, if you've been following her updates on social or just follow what she's up to, curious about what she's doing over there, we would love it if you emailed some questions to theadventurestash@paysonmckelvin.com or sent them over social media, whatever works easier. Just a heads up on that. Also, just a heads up that I published another one of those visual podcast type videos to YouTube. This time it was the Santavai Stage 1 Hill Climb Prologue, 17 minutes, super crazy dynamic race. And per your feedback, we included power, heart rate, speed, and other metrics on there. So you can go enjoy that. It's already been getting lots of love. And lastly, I want to say thank you to Dometic for supporting today's episode. They've been an amazing supporter the last couple of years, and they're back with an awesome discount code. 15% off site-wide this time. It used to just be on their outdoor gear, but I tried it. It works on anything. So even their home category of things, auto category of things like console coolers, all that sort of thing. Code is Payson15 at checkout. Personally, though, you know, we're gearing up for a warm summer of racing and maybe some camping trips. And Dometic always has you covered when it comes to camping gear, powered coolers, portable lithium batteries, all that sort of thing. So Dometic.com, Dometic.com, Payson15 at checkout for 15% off. Thank you all so much for listening today, and we'll catch you after the show. Okay, Cynthia, we are here in Bentonville, Arkansas, and are both probably still drying out. You're the only other person I saw riding today.
You were the only person I saw riding today as well.
When I was rolling down that hill, so I had a pretty hard interval workout, and I was rolling down Sunset,
I think it's called.
I'm gradually figuring out the routes here. It's still a total maze to
me. That one is close to my home, so I use that for workouts.
Yeah. I was coming around the corner. I was like, holy shit, who is that? And then I recognized you. I was like, that's badass. It actually made me stoked.
Oh, that's good.
What was your ride today?
Oh, just a short two and a half hour ride. Basically, I'm dealing with a slight knee issue. Yeah. So I'm just testing out my legs a little bit before starting up some workouts, which is good.
Yeah. And I mean, in theory, you're headed off to a race later this week, right?
I am actually going to volunteer because I don't think Coach would be so happy if I told him I was going to go and ride 400 miles this weekend. So yeah, I will go volunteer and ride out that way down South Doom. The riding around it is beautiful. Have you been down that direction
Where
yet?
Is it?
Starts at the Buffalo Headwaters. It's beautiful. It's the Ozark National Forest. It's super pretty.
I've done one road ride out there. Mm-hmm. And I was so stoked the whole time. So I can only imagine what the gravel is like.
The gravel is, yeah. That was part of the reason why I moved to Bentonville. Because when I rode down there, I thought this is very much like home. This is like the Blue Ridge, like the Appalachians.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So just quickly, what is your attitude about riding on a day like today? Because I see ultra racers as almost inhumanly tough. But when you see it steady raining and like barely breaking 50 degrees, do you feel dread or are you just impenetrable to that sort of psychological thing that us mortals have to deal with?
You know, for me, I would say actually the hardest part about it is just putting all of this stuff for rain gear, like rain pants, rain booties, the jacket, and deciding what amount of clothing you actually want to wear because the temperature fluctuates. Once you put all that on, it gets really hot. But the actual riding, I love it. You know, we race in the rain all the time, so it's better to just suck it up and I don't even know if I would say suck it up, just deal with it basically.
Yeah, fair enough. So you said knee injury?
You know, it's like a light tendonitis, basically overuse, I think, from Atlas.
Yeah.
It's a lot of time in the saddle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Atlas Mountain Race, listeners will be familiar because we talked to Ulrich about this race where he
got taken out by a dog.
Yeah. Ended up being a funny story. Probably wasn't in the moment. Mm-mm. One thing I'm noticing, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like you're defaulting to racing overseas a little more often than is common for an American ultra racer. Mm-hmm. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I would say I don't think there are any Americans. Well, there are a few men that are traveling over to the European and South America and Central America as well. Mm-hmm. There's some racing that we have good races.
Yeah. So why is that?
I would say it's much different in terms of competition. Usually there's a bigger and better women's field, so it's more competitive. Mm-hmm. I think Across Andes had 30 plus women racing when I did it 2 years ago. So yeah, big deal. And then same with Atlas, I think it was 25 women. So a deeper field. And then the races are in cool places. I want to travel, like it's a vacation. Yeah. Part of the reason I started doing it was just because I liked the idea of being a tourist in a new place and like doing that by bike and seeing what somebody found as a route. And they're usually from that area. So it's kind of like vacation and I get to race my bike. It's like all these exciting things, kind of like what gravel racing was in the US before I started traveling outside. Yeah. Very similar to that.
So that discovery experience is really key to why you do this discipline.
Yeah, definitely. I would also say the US racing, as good as the routes are, it's more Grand Apart style. And for me, the Grand Apart style is cool, but the media attention and the competition that goes along with the European and South American races are usually better.
Hmm.
So in the long run, I get recognized and, you know, it just helps my career.
Yeah.
Attending those races.
So win-win. How are they different than a typical Grand Depart style format?
Usually there's more than 75 people. So typical Grand Depart is the reason why they do it that way often is because you can't get permits unless, or if they get a permit, it's like multiple permits for ultra racing. There's so many different places you have to get permits through if it's National Forest, whatever. And then they just don't, I think, want to make it too big of an event because that requires a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Badlands, I don't know, 300 or 400 people do it every year. So it's a lot different than the 75 that show up to Stagecoach, which is happening next weekend, Doom, which is also happening this weekend. So
Colorado Trail.
Arizona. Yeah, what those are all that.
Tour Divide, same. Though? There's a couple hundred that do that
actually,
typically, right?
Technically, no. Oh. It's a Grand Apart as well. And we were having this conversation the other day. I was with some friends, and I think because it starts
in Canada. Interesting.
It can be different, but they do have a limit on the number of people that they like technically start, okay. I think.
Gray areas.
Yeah. I don't know. I haven't researched it much because the Tour Divide is not on my list, at least on my short list right now.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? Same reasons? Like it wouldn't be as much of an exploratory.
Yeah, I think I can go to the U.S. anytime. It's a really cool country. I mean, it's really beautiful. But I want to explore the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And also, it is kind of expensive. I think people spend like $3,000 to $4,000 when they do it. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, takes, depending on how fast you do it, in 15 to 20 days. That's a lot of money to spend in that amount of time. Gas station stops are not cheap.
Totally,
it's like $100 if you go to the gas station twice in one day.
Yeah, that's so crazy.
Yeah.
That's a really good point. Interesting. Mm-hmm. And in Europe, I mean, other than prices just being low, I mean, that's something that I really got an appreciation for basing in Girona this year. It's crazy how expensive the States is.
Mm-hmm.
But why else are international races more budget friendly typically?
I would say depending on the race, like if you're racing in Norway, Bright Midnight is an ultra, which I plan to do, but I hear it's very expensive and you spend a lot of money.
Yeah.
Whereas like Girona, Spain, Italy, they're less expensive. That's where a good number of races are and places that I've like always wanted to see. So I've actually raced a bunch in Spain and also in Italy in the last 2-ish years.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say if I was racing in a more expensive country, yeah, like Norway or France can also be expensive.
Yeah, it is funny that you can come out ahead even with an international flight.
Mm-hmm.
It's wild. Mm-hmm. Cool. Okay. Atlas Mountain Race. You won.
Yes.
You finished 8th overall?
I finished 15th overall. Yeah, I got 8th.
I'm thinking of Badlands.
Yeah, 8th overall Badlands.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Big race. How many starters were at Atlas?
200 to 250.
Yeah, that's crazy.
It's a lot.
So one thing that I talked to Ulrich about a little bit is how it seems like ultra racing in the States and ultra racing in Europe are not on divergent paths, but they have very distinct feels.
Mm-hmm.
You talked a minute ago about how there seems to be more general enthusiasm, maybe even outside of like the small circle of the sport for the race.
Mm-hmm.
Is that fair to say?
Yeah. I think dot watching is what we would call it. The dot watching in general for all ultras, like people get excited about it.
Yeah.
But the bigger races, because they're more well known, they're showing up in like media and things like that. The reason is that there's more attention on those races. And so that's why people are going to them rather than maybe lining up at a race in the US that nobody's ever heard of because there's not any media attention.
Yeah. Do you think some of it is just that bike racing is a mainstream sport in Europe?
I have thought about that before, actually. And, you know, like there's a woman who is French. Her name is Natalie Bayon. She actually got second at the race. And she is doing exactly what I'm doing and also doing very well in the races. And she's been able to make it and like do like all kinds of like camps and stuff as like part of her job. And I think it's just I think the difference is here versus maybe there is like it's just so more well known. Like, cycling is a widely known sport in Europe that it's like able to support her in that way. Whereas in the US, we're in Bentonville. It's like that maybe here, but not really many other places.
Yeah. And in theory, that translates to more female participation as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. So I followed Atlas Mountain Race. Mm. It was really fun to follow. And I've definitely started following you more as part of you. You know, you're sort of in a similar family now with the mm-hmm. Orange Seal Academy yeah, crew, yeah. which is fun.
Yeah,
it's and it's cool. been fun to talk to our mutual coach, Dennis, a little bit about what you're up to. And he's even spilled the beans a little bit now and then about your mindset, which is really interesting, and what it's like to coach an athlete like you, which is really cool.
Hopefully he said all good things.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, basically, like, you can boil it down to pretty much one sentence, which is basically that you'll run through a brick wall. Like, that's kind of what it came down to, which could be a great thing when it comes to ultra racing, but when it comes to coaching, can present good things and challenges.
Yes, hence the knee injury. I'm like, I'm fine. He's like, no, I think you should take today off. I'm like, but it's fine.
So at what point did you discover the style racing, and why do you think you decided to make this what you focus on?
I was always a bike rider in my like adult life, and I raced crits and I did triathlons for a little bit. Then gravel started happening, and I really liked that style of racing. I liked the adventure part of it. I think that's what I was missing on the road. And then the pandemic happened, so I started doing a lot longer rides because I had more time to stay closer to home. Basically, I wasn't traveling for races as often. And when the pandemic sort of started subsiding, I had been doing these really long back-to-back weekend days where I lived, and thought like, well, this is cool. Maybe I could do something a little longer. And Unbound was rolling around again, and it was going to be, you know, this big, big thing. Everyone was going to Unbound the year after pandemic ended. Yeah. And I had done it in 2019 when it was still Dirty Kansas at that time. And it's funny because I still look back and I laugh at myself. I said I would never do something like that again. Like, I would never allow myself to ride that long.
The 200.
Yeah, the 200. Yeah. Uh-huh. But then, you know, 2021 rolls around and I didn't want to do the 200 because I just didn't want to be a part of the whole thing. Like, I had had that time, but the 350 was there and I thought, you know what? I'm going to do the 350. And my teammate, Rachel, at the time, I was like, hey, you want to do this with me? She said, sure, why not? She'd done the 200 a couple times and we just decided to sign up. So I was kind of training for that. And so I did the first thing I did was just to practice riding overnight, because that's what everyone suggests if you're going to do an ultra, ride through the night. It was 250 miles with 25,000 feet of elevation gain, or 26. It was,
ouch.
Yeah. Like, that's what the riding, where I'm from is used to in Virginia. So yep. I love that kind of up, lots of fun down. And Unbound was very different than that. But I learned that I liked it. I learned I loved the challenge, and I knew that I could get better at it. So I signed up for Badlands in 2021, and I competed against Lael Wilcox, who has been on the show before. And she kicked my butt. I think she beat me by like 7 hours or something. Uh-huh. And I was like, God damn it, I know I can do better than this. So I just became addicted at perfecting it. I wanted to get to the finish line first, but I also was like, I know I can be better at this. Like, it's not just about bike riding. It's about everything else. You know, you have to navigate the food, all of the things that go into it. Whereas if you're doing a lifetime Grand Prix race, it's a lot less thinking. I mean, there's still a lot of thinking, but you're usually focused on just pedaling your bike and taking in the calories. Mm-hmm. And ultra racing it's a puzzle.
There's a survival component. Like, when you're making decisions for the Grand Prix, it's about like, where can I save 5 seconds here, 10 seconds there. Mm-hmm. And in ultra, you have to take care of yourself.
Self-care, it's the most important.
Yeah. So I want to rewind for just a second. I'm curious about, so you mentioned that you started doing these big back-to-back rides, which sounds like a small thing, but most people would not do two huge rides back-to-back and be like, I like this. So I'm curious, what do you think I mean, this is pretty broad, but when you were discovering that you liked long bike rides, what was it?
It started community-based. It was friends that were like, we're going to go, we don't have a lot going on, pandemic is subsiding, but do you want to go and ride and then camp and then ride again? And that was really what it started as. And I had a friend also where I was living before. He was into like actual racing of ultras. And I thought I could never do it, but I was just so impressed by him. And so we would ride, and just the experience that I had with other people is, I think, what kind of got me into doing it. I wouldn't probably gone out and done 200 mile, 10,000 feet rides back to back. But because I did it with others, that was like the gateway drug, basically.
Yeah, fair enough. And so we've talked about how you've fallen in love with racing, in, well, globally, outside of the U.S., but it sounds like you made the decision to race internationally pretty early. You did DKXL at the time, or maybe it was Unbound.
It was Unbound that year.
Mm-hmm. Unbound. And then your very next ultra was Badlands. Mm-hmm. Why do you think you gravitated towards that right off the bat?
You know, I saw it on the internet, actually. I thought, I liked that area in Spain. I'd done the road training camp a couple years back in that area in southern Spain. I thought, you know, I'd love to go back. And they have good media, and they have good, you know, there's everything about the race looked really cool. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to sign up. Why not? Actually, I went for a ride, and I didn't realize it like sold out. And so I was out on a ride. I went to look, and it had sold out in like the 5 minutes that it had been open. I was so disappointed. But thankfully, at that time, they had a wait list. So I got on the wait list, and then I was able to get into the race.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I didn't actually plan on bringing up this topic today, but it just came to mind because you mentioned the media and that drew you in. Mm. In Europe, they're far more open to media coverage of these races. Do you have any perspectives on, because that's another huge difference between the US and European racing. And it is interesting how, you know, I see more content easily from ultra races in Europe as opposed to the US. And, you know, there's this very well-known, very talked about hardline stance against that for a few of the key events in the US. Mm-hmm. Do you think about that much, or since it doesn't affect you, you don't really?
I definitely think about it. Mm-hmm. For example, I was just in Morocco for Alice Mountain Race, and I was not able to have a media team. I would have if I could, but the race organizer, the race promoter, Nelson Trees, plans the media, and he has a team out there. He actually had a women's coverage team. So for me, it's a little bit disappointing that I can't have a team covering it, because I would benefit significantly. That race is huge, like the coverage, and, you know, just all kinds of good things can come from having a media team. But they had one, so it worked out. I didn't get video from it, but I had plenty of photos, and sponsors were happy. It was great. You can use them for news articles, whatever. The races that do allow for media coverage is awesome. I'm going to the Traca, and I have like a full-blown media project plan. I'm releasing like 5 videos. I've got a race video, bike check video, a bunch of like athlete interviews. Mm-hmm. It's going to be super cool, and I'm stoked about it, and it'll be good for everybody involved. Mm-hmm. Sponsors, also be good for the person who does all my video work. Like, it's a great opportunity for all of the parties involved. Mm-hmm. And it really pushes me forward. And if I win the race, the Traca 560, it's the first year they're holding it. So just having a video about my race is huge through the filter of my experience, not necessarily like what the race is covering. I think the race promoter gets to decide. It's their race. I put a race on myself, and, you know, I understand the race organizer gets to make the choice. I think the hard thing is with these Grand Apart style races, they're so hard line that it actually just doesn't help the sport grow. And that's the hardest part about it all, is I watched every single one of Wilcox's videos. I have seen them all because I wanted to know all of the things. You know, I was so interested, and there was not a lot of other media out there about it.
She, in a lot of ways, sorry to interrupt, but
all good.
Correct me if you have a different perspective, but she brought bikepacking to the world in a lot of ways, it feels like, or
yeah,
at least took
US,
it to a completely
sure.
other
yeah.
level.
Yeah, I would say that Lael is instrumental in so many people getting stoked about the idea of traveling by bike. It's always been there.
Yeah.
But for people that didn't really know that it was possible, her projects with Rue and even before Rue, like those things that she was sharing are part of the reason why I kept going in the sport, because I thought, you know, if she can do it, so can I. Mm-hmm. It's all about representation. So if somebody can see me doing it, maybe it will encourage them to get out there and try, even if it's just like a one nighter to the park down the street. It doesn't have to be this big, massive race in Morocco.
Yep.
Just get out and ride your bike and sleep outside.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. Does it feel like a sacrifice for you to have media? I mean, obviously there's the, to me, with the few projects that I've done, there's definitely an element of, it makes you slower because you are balancing so many things, organizing things, from a performance standpoint, creating media around these big, big efforts is not a plus. it has huge professional pluses, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But you've talked about how much you enjoy, you know, the exploratory aspect of these races. Does it change the experience much for you?
You know, I think for me, a media team being around doesn't actually make that much of a difference for me. I'm there to do what I'm there to do. I'm very competitive. And if there's a race, I'm not even going to pay attention to the media, which is important because then it's showing actually what I'm doing, which is racing.
Yeah.
If I was, you know, I do have a project plan later this year that's kind of more about just like experience. We're going on a bikepacking trip with some other women. And that's going to be super cool. And that's going to take time. But during the race, I don't even pull my phone out. I've taken one photo, maybe two at Badlands. I was racing my bike. I don't know. I think it took me, 46 hours? I slept for 10 minutes. And I was riding the whole time, basically. And I took my phone out one time, and the photo was terrible. So, like, I'm not focusing on anything except racing.
Yeah.
I do feel a little bit of excitement when I see somebody out on course. It doesn't have to be my media team. It could be anybody, you know. So there's that. It's like a kid standing on the side of the road cheering, or a farmer out moving his goats.
Mm-hmm.
I get excited about that.
Yeah.
This is a human connection.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Okay. Going back to your most recent race. There's this awesome, and I can't remember who posted it. It might've even been the event, but there's this great little video clip of you like deep in this store/restaurant looking thing, like way in a back room, and you're just kind of hunkered down, like shoveling food down. and there's these, you know, local Moroccan folks kind of helping you as they can. And what struck me about it is you looked so comfortable in a foreign land and just totally in your element.
Mm.
Can you, for people who haven't done this sort of thing, can you describe what it's like to completely integrate into a different place like that? Because I think one thing that's interesting about athlete, like when you're doing something really hard, when you're trying to complete, how long is Atlas?
1300K, so 800 miles.
Yeah, four plus day race, 5 day race, whatever it is. You have to rely on the environment around you to succeed, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whatever stores are available, whatever community folks are willing to lend you a hand. And there's so much vulnerability there. Like you're doing something really hard, you're sleep deprived, you have to trust people like crazy. Different language, totally different culture. Can you describe a little bit of what that's like? Because I assume that's a huge part of what has you hooked on this.
Yeah, I love the unknown. It's very exciting to hear from other people and their suggestions on how to navigate it, because you know, you do want to learn as much as you can before going in. I may not be Ulrich Bartholomew, who learns every single possible detail, But it is really important to know, okay, well, they eat omelets everywhere. You can get an omelet everywhere. Just to know those things is really important. I also like a little bit of surprise, like an element of, you know, that's part of the adventure for me. The first time I remember, I actually, when I raced Badlands, I was unsure of how to deal with the culture difference. And not like it's huge, but it was definitely a learning curve for me, racing in another country and dealing with that. Now I've raced in Chile and Colombia and the US and France and Italy and Spain. So now I kind of get that. I know how to deal with it. I know how to not let it get to me and just kind of roll with the punches. I always say practice makes prepared. So, you know, each race is a practice and being more prepared for the next one. Morocco definitely was a unique experience. My first time, the first time I slept three times. I knew I needed to sleep, and I was coming to a town about 24 hours and 26 or 7 hours into the race, and there was no hotels. They don't really have those kinds of things in the small towns. So I asked the local shopkeeper if they knew where I could sleep, and they said, "You can sleep in my house." And I said, "Okay, sure." So I fought. He took me around the building. There was a bunch of people out, and Moroccan people are known for being friendly. They're known for being hospitable. So I fully trusted this person. He took me into his house, showed me the room, which I'm pretty sure was where him and his wife slept.
Oh, wow.
And said, "You can sleep here." And I motioned to shower, and he took me to the washroom, and they turned on the tap, cold water in a bucket, and I got all my stuff. I took a bath, like a shower out of the bucket, and I slept for like 3 hours and then got up and left. And as I was leaving, they were all sitting at the dinner table, like chatting. I don't know. It was like 11 p.m. at night, and they said bye. And it was like just such a wild experience. I thought, this is so cool. Yeah. What a life experience I'll never forget.
Yeah. Yeah. Ulrich didn't have quite as great accommodations. He got locked in.
That was such an amazing story.
Have you had any moments where just putting complete trust in a stranger in a faraway land got a little dicey?
I have not yet. I have a lot of trust in the world. I think it's because I'm not actually sure why, but I just trust everybody. I leave the keys in my car. If you live in Bentonville and you see my Fiat out, the keys are probably in it. So if you need a ride, it's there. I just trust the world. And one day that's going to bite me in the butt, especially in racing, I'm sure. But yeah, I haven't had any bad experiences. But I think partly it's because I have a lot of like understanding of how to read people. And I think that is very helpful as well, especially in racing. I am a little bit nervous, though, when I see people and I want to ask if they know where I can find water. I'm getting better at that, but okay. I still struggle in being somebody who stops a person on the side of the street. Asking them interesting. A question.
Like inconveniences someone.
Yeah, I never want to inconvenience anybody. Yeah. So I'm learning. Actually, yesterday on my ride, I was coming back on Sugar Creek and I needed water so bad. And I would have never asked, but I saw someone outside and I thought, just damn it, ask him. So I was like, "Can I have some water?" Yeah. Filled in my water bottle and I left. It's just nice. Practicing, you know, like practice makes prepared.
That's great. Okay. So it is funny that you say practice makes prepared, because for anyone that's watched the Badlands film, it kind of seems like that's the only preparation you do potentially. Was that in the Badlands film where you have that moment with Ulrich?
Yes. At the very, we're like 2 days before the race start and I'm looking at the race map for the first time.
Yeah. So you two could not be any more different when it comes so to how different. You approach this.
Yeah.
But simultaneously, you just mentioned how competitive you are. Mm. So do you just feel like you don't need that extra preparation and the quote unquote, like small stuff, the marginal gains that can maybe make you go faster? Mm. Or would it work against whatever drives you and whatever you get out of the sport? Mm-hmm. Like, what do you think that's about?
Yeah, ooh, that is a good question. I think I'm inherently a lazy person.
I don't know.
So for me, the like getting on the computer and like opening up 10 tabs and looking at all this stuff. I did that for Atlas this year. And I actually, because of Dennis, because of our shared coach, who was like, you know, you should probably look through the map a little bit. I was like, okay, fine. I did ask a bunch of friends who have done ultras and do like route planning and stuff, and like ask them to walk me through what they do. So I'm getting better at it. But yeah, I definitely, it's the last thing I want to do before a race. There's so much organizing. You have to make sure you've packed everything. Actually, at Mid-South this last weekend, I forgot some things. And my friend Caro, who I went with, was like, you're so unorganized. I was like, girl, I have to be so dialed for ultras. Like, this race is just fun. I don't really care. You know, I have to have everything checked over 15 times, because if I forget something and I'm out in the middle of nowhere, I'm going to have some problems.
Yeah.
So
what was it like to jump in Mid-South for you? Just the absolute like hectic.
I love it though.
Really?
Yeah. I was not allowed to race. That was like a hard line. There was no racing allowed. So that was hard because I am super competitive. I just rode it. I just kept steady the whole day, and I rode with my friend Carol. So it was great. We had a really good time, but it was super hard to hold back. Like, I was talking about maybe doing the 50, and Sarah Sturm was like, if you win the 50, we're going to have some problems.
There's going to be a riot.
I was like, I promise I won't. I did the 100, funny. But yeah, no, it was hard to hold back, yeah. For sure.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about preparation real quick, or gear. Mm. This is one of the things that is most fun about mm-hmm. what you do. And I've dipped just enough of a toe in to, you know, have a feel for just
how... You gotta dip more than a toe. Come on, Payson.
I know. Got this dang Grand Prix thing.
2025, Badlands. I can see it in your future.
One of these days. But it is so fun to just, like, explode a living room with all of these weird mm-hmm. trinkets mm-hmm. that will help you survive and cross a huge distance. Without giving away any trade secrets, are there any few... interesting things that you really don't start without or have come to really, really appreciate that might surprise people?
Oh, you know, I think my packing list is pretty similar to most people's, but I think a couple additional things that are surprising, or actually less of things. I don't use a hydration pack. I really cannot stand anything on my back. And after, you know, 3 or 4 days of racing, that weight is just terrible. So I, depending on the race, am set up water differently, but I have a 1.5 liter bladder that I put in my Fram bag. And so that's something that when people see that, they're stoked on it. They're like, wow, I didn't even think about that. I also am somebody that doesn't need to use as much light as most people.
Oh, interesting.
I always have backups. Like, you have to have backups on backups of everything. Mm-hmm. 2 battery packs, 2 lights, 2 tail lights. It's super important because you never know. You might lose something. I always lose shit. Literally, the amount of times Atlas, at like the last 5 hours, I lost my AirPods. So I had one in my ear and it died like an hour before the finish. And it was so sad.
Brutal.
But
what do you listen to? Sorry.
Oh, yeah. This is a question we always ask on the podcast that I do with a friend about ultras, detours. Yeah. We often get a lot of people that say they listen to podcasts.
Uh-huh. Oh, you're saying you ask, because you have a podcast.
I do have a podcast.
We'll talk about that in a minute, but yeah. This is what you ask guests,
yeah.
You're saying.
We gotcha. Always ask guests the same question, and I it's hard because I want to say everything, and it's true, I do listen to everything. Music, a lot, but I get tired. I mean, think about the amount of hours that I'm training and riding races. It's a lot. So the music that I like, I kind of get sick of it after a while. Like, I've listened to the same playlist too many times. Yeah. So podcasts are good. I actually listened to a ton of your podcasts during Atlas.
Nice.
And the one with Jack was super good.
Yeah.
I liked that one.
What a mm-hmm. guy. Yeah.
And books on tape. My mom and I, we will pick one often that we listen to together.
Oh,
or like
that's
she'll
so
listen
sweet.
To it and then I'll listen to it and then we'll talk about it after the race.
Yeah.
So yeah, I usually, in terms of music, I will, depending on the start, sometimes they start in the morning, sometimes they start in the evening. I will try and wait 12 hours to use headphones.
Yeah.
So I'm like focused in the moment and in the race. And then when I need like a little bit of encouragement or reward, I get to put a headphone in.
Yep.
So, yeah.
I hear that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, back to gear. So let's actually talk about your general setup. Mm-hmm. I think people would be, this is a very cliche podcast question, but what kind of bikes do you race? Mm-hmm. What did your Atlas setup look like, and what kind of bag setup have you settled on?
Mm. Bags are always changing, kind of figuring out which ones work. It depends on the bike too. So I ride 3T bikes, and they've got two that I really race on. Actually, really three, but I'll race Traca on their new bike. It's called the Extrema. It's so cool. You can ride 2.2 tires on 700C on it. So yeah, it's super rad. Atlas setup though, I was on a hardtail. You definitely need suspension for Atlas. It's a chunky. It's not that technical. It's just really chunky. Mm-hmm. I'm still dealing with some numbness from it in my hands. The setup was full frame bag. So no water bottle cages, which was a little bit of an interesting kind of science project, because I had to figure out where I would put a bottle so I could put drink mix in it.
Oh, yeah.
So I put aero bars on, and then I had a bottle on the aero bars, actually, because Lachlan had them on his Tour Divide setup. Yeah. And I was like, damn, I'm doing that. Brilliant. That's genius. And then he had a computer mount on top of that. So I did that. And then... what else did I have? I had this new product that just came out by Old Man Mountain. They make like different racks and things, and they made this axle pack that allows you to put water on your front fork using the axle rather than
the stanchions. Yeah.
And that's bad for your fork, putting that weight on the stanchions.
Interesting.
So using it through the axle was better, and it basically allowed me to put these cages on either side. And then I would use a Voile strap and put on like a 1.5 liter bottle on either side. Yep. Granted, sucks to ride when it's like that.
Yeah,
it's super tough.
Oh my God,
it's so weird.
Even weirder when you take it all off.
Yeah, because you're like, oh, God.
Riding to the store, yes. Crashing for no reason.
Yeah, when you don't have a saddlebag on after riding with a saddlebag for so many miles, it's very weird because your like counterbalance is off.
Yeah.
But I'll ride with a saddlebag, a top tube bag, and I carry a Musette bag that folds up. So if I go to a store, I can put everything in that and then just kind of carry it. If I want, I can also put water. I've done that before, put water in it. And then on like a hydration pack, you can put it away. So it's helpful. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's a good one. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
So you just mentioned numb hands.
Mm.
Again, chatting with Dennis a little bit, it sounds like you'll stop at nothing during these events. And I do want to talk about that. But I also want to talk about the health component.
Mm.
Not like the responsibility of it, but just what it's like to really break down your body. Mm. I did a ill-fated like kamikaze effort on the Colorado Trail one time. And... really beat up my hands and feet to the point where I think it took like, I don't know, 6 weeks or more to get normal feeling back in my hands and feet.
Mm.
And that, for me, that scared me. I was like, this is sketchy. This feels like maybe something I shouldn't be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then talking to more bike packers, you know, it sounds like to an extent it gets a little bit normalized. Someone like Kurt Refsnyder like uses the suspension bar because his hands are so beat up over the years, nerve wise. Does that stuff give you any pause, or is like the richness of the life experience just plenty to overcome that price to pay?
I haven't done a ton of really long racing. So my longest one now was just Atlas, which was 4 days, 19 hours. And other than that, it's been 80 hours or less, 90 hours or less. So this long distance stuff is where you start to see that long-term damage. Previously, I have had nerve damage, and I did have a little bit of a freak out when it first happened because it did take a while. I think it took 4 or 5 weeks. So they say nerve damage is 4 to 6 weeks of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I had nerve damage in the bottom of my feet also. So I had it in my hands and my feet, and I had it in my hands in a place that was different than where most people experience it. I had it in my median nerve, where your ulnar nerve is the, or median is the, anyway, I had it in a place that wasn't normal. So it was even more scary because people were like, yeah, I've never experienced that there.
Yeah, that's tough.
So I got a bike fit actually, who knew, as an ultra cyclist, it's probably good to have a bike pit. Oh, it just goes along with my whole laissez-faire attitude about everything. Yeah, now I just know that it's a thing, and I've found ways, like, acupuncture really helps.
Interesting.
Super helpful. I saw somebody, I probably spent more money on acupuncture and recovery from Atlas than I did on Atlas, actually. Oh, wow. Which is crazy to think, but acupuncture is great. And then just making sure your body is, like, really strong in all of the ways. So, like, practicing hand strength. I use, like, Chinese medicine balls that help with hand strength. Because, like, for a while, I couldn't open Ziploc bags. I literally couldn't button my pants.
Yeah.
Like, that's how messed up my hands were from the grip strength, like, the lack of. They're still not great. I don't know. I think I'm 5-6 weeks out or something like that, or 5 weeks from the race. So it's definitely something that gives me a little bit of pause, but I'm so addicted to it.
Yeah.
And it's been helpful because Dennis is over here like, well, you know, you probably don't need to do that race. You've already done it and you won it once. Like, do you need to go back and do it? Like, okay, yeah. Maybe not. So having somebody else who sees the bigger picture is helpful because it means I'm doing the important events, but I'm not overdoing it.
Yep.
Like, I'm not racing Doom this weekend. Even though I want to, I'm not.
Yep. Yeah. I know you got trench foot during Atlas. Dude, and you... weren't you, like, sitting at a gas station just airing out your feet?
Yes.
Normal bike racing stuff.
I've actually had trench foot before. Even worse. I race in Colombia in February, the Trans Cordilleras, and both of my feet had it, and I'd never experienced it before. That was a crazy race because I slept on a bus station, like, not even a bus station, under a bus station, like, roof on the floor in between two people. We had two emergency blankets, one on the ground and one on top of us.
Oh my gosh.
And we slept there for like 2.5 hours because it was storming. So, like, it was raining cats and dogs. So that was a unique life experience there. But the trench foot was the first time I'd had that. It feels like rocks. Have you ever had it before?
No.
Oh my God.
What describe it, because everyone knows the term and have probably seen photos.
Oh
my
God.
But what exactly is happening?
Your feet are wrinkly. So you know, you look at them and you're like, oh, I just have pruny feet. But when you, before you see your feet, before you actually realize how pruny they are, it starts to feel like there are rocks in your shoe under your feet. Imagine like a bunch of little pebbles just constantly. Every time you go down, you just feel that pain.
That sounds like a weird horror movie.
It is. Yeah, it's pretty terrible. I had it in 1 foot though, just 1 foot during Atlas, because I was doing a river crossing and my 1 foot got down, and that's when it got splashed. And I thought it would dry because it's the desert, so I wasn't worried about it. Actually, wet feet are my number one biggest fear. If there is something where my feet are going to get wet, I will actually take my shoes and socks off and walk through it, because trench foot's terrible. Mm-hmm. It is really uncomfortable. I hope you never experience it. but yeah, I basically decided it was better. It was hurting so bad. And I thought, you know what? I'll just sit here and take my shoes and socks off in this very busy bar cafe thing on the side of the road. Like, kids running around, and just sat there with my feet out. A couple cats came and said hello. There was another racer. We hung out, you know.
Did it go away? Did it help?
It did go away. Yeah, it made it, because it was dry enough in the air. I mean, I sat there for 45 minutes to an hour, I think. Mm-hmm. And it was hot out at that time, so it helped. Yeah, that was a fun experience.
Yeah. So when stuff like this is happening, I remember from my Colorado Trail thing and even Tasmania, like, when you start to lose dexterity and strength in your hands, and you're trying to do basic stuff like get a snack out of your pocket or pack a jacket away, that combined with such significant fatigue, maybe it's even the middle of the night, like, keeping your nerve can be challenging. And my experience is it almost starts to feel like claustrophobic in a way, like slightly panicky if you're not really on top, because you're so sleep deprived too, that like your brain isn't working the same way. How do you work through those periods? Do you just have enough experience now that you recognize that it's happening and just like keep moving? Or
yeah, I would say it's kind of like hallucinating. I remember the first time I hallucinated, I was like, oh my God, I can't function, this is weird. And now I just like I can ride through the hallucination. And it's the same thing. It's when shit starts to hit the fan and I'm racing and I feel overwhelmed, I just kind of look down at the ground and think, just keep moving. Occasionally, I can get bad, but it's usually because I haven't eaten. It's like almost always.
Oh, interesting.
Your everything is low. Yeah. So yeah, where they say like, if you have a mechanical, eat first, then fix the mechanical. If you're having a breakdown, eat first and then deal with the breakdown.
Interesting. Yeah, that totally makes sense. Mm-hmm. That reminds me of something else. So something I hate that I'm not bringing this back to my experiences over and over again on purpose, but it reminded me because do you know Emma Flukes? Does that name ring a bell?
I don't actually.
So she lives in Tasmania and she's an Australian bikepacker. But she was making so much fun of me because I was packing so much food for this thing because I have experience from shorter races.
Mm-hmm.
And also I think there's a little bit of a metabolism thing going on where my engine just kind of like runs hot because I'm always doing short races.
Yeah.
And I'm fixated on this like minimum 50 grams an hour thing. You have a background in shorter racing. How has it been transitioning to this stuff in terms of fueling? Like, how do you deal with that?
It's challenging. I'm used to, well, when I was racing crits, I was just 1 hour race, taking a gel and that was it.
Yeah.
And then gravel racing, I started to learn how to properly fuel. And I felt like I got pretty good at it. But with ultra racing, it's just so hard.
It's a shit show.
It's literally a shit show. That's the only way you can describe it. Yeah. Like, it's so hard to eat when you've been riding for 4 days. The last thing you want to do is eat whatever it is that you have.
Yeah.
Except maybe I would like a nice pizza would be great. Mm-hmm. Very rarely do you find something like that. And even when you do, a lot of times you're like, oh, I just don't feel like eating this. Yeah. But I've actually learned better nutrition tactics in the last year than I was doing when I was gravel racing. I definitely cannot get 50 grams of carbs per hour when I'm like, people talk about 100. I'm like, I cannot imagine trying to get that amount of carbohydrates.
Well, that's racing. I mean, yeah, for sure. So racing, like it's 100 plus, but I just mean endurance riding, I do 50.
Yeah. And for me, that's hard. I eat every 45 minutes and it's usually like 30 grams, which is not enough, but it's pretty challenging to eat. You get chew fatigue.
Yeah. Do you get sores ever like on your tongue? And
you know, if you brush your teeth, then you can usually avoid that.
Okay.
Also, another thing is like, for example, the scratch gummies, they don't make your tongue feel weird, but regular gummies might.
Yep.
So it depends on the food quality you're eating, which sucks because when you're riding in the middle of nowhere, the gas stations in, you know, wherever, or the, you know, the state, like they don't even have gas stations in Morocco, the like small stores, all they've got is like dried biscuits. And you're like, got another dried biscuit. Here we go.
Wow.
Okay. Definitely a challenge.
So I want to dig in a little bit to this mindset of yours. So you've talked about how you're really competitive. When you're really in the throes of just mega discomfort, what is it that you think is driving you? Like, why do you so bad? Why are you willing to give yourself trench foot, ride through the night, like make your muscles hurt so badly, you know, get weird aches and pains, whatever, just completely decimate your body to do the best that you can?
I'm definitely competitive. I think that's like probably one of the number one things. I've always been competitive. I've got older brothers. I never thought that they were different than me. They were older than me. And that was the only thing that made a difference. And I think that really leaks over into like ultra racing. I don't look at the men who are racing and think that they're faster than me. I look at them as somebody on an even playing field. So if I have somebody near me that's riding in the dark and I feel like garbage, I'm definitely not going to let that person out of my sight. They're going to, unless they really are going super hard. I'm pretty good at riding within my own limits at this point. Now I know that person is going too fast. They're either much stronger than me or they're going to explode. Mm-hmm. It's something that I have started to learn against, especially competing against other women. But I think just the idea that I want to get to the finish line, and if I slow down, it's going to take longer. But also, I'm really good at taking the pain and just like completely filing it away. And like, when things are really hard, I'm able to kind of take a step back or dissociate from the pain. And that's something I've worked on over the years. It's not something I just like immediately was like, okay, this hurts, I'm gonna forget about the pain.
Yeah.
If you're fueled properly, you can start to do that. If you're breaking down and you're on the side of the road sobbing, it's not so great. But most of the time I don't get that low. Usually my mindset, I guess I like to say I'm really lucky. I get to be there. I get to do mm-hmm. what I'm doing. I'm not a world tour racer. I'm not out here like 6, 7, 8 watts per kilo. Like, I'm not that fast, but I'm really good at suffering and I'm good at all the puzzle pieces. And that together is why I guess I race ultras and I push myself, because
yeah,
it's a puzzle.
Yeah, interesting. Do you have any stories that come to mind of when you just really, really dug deep or had to push through some crazy dark place?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can recently think back to Badlands this last year. I was, I don't know, maybe 100K like to the finish, and I was competing against the second place woman, Kara Dixon, almost the whole time. Basically, I think from 150K to 750K. So we were together, we were back and forth racing for a while, and I definitely race better if I'm ahead. I shouldn't say that on the podcast because I was going to use that against me, but I race better when I'm ahead. And so I was ahead of her for the second half of the race, the majority of it. And knowing that she was close, checking the tracker, I mean, I was so impressed with myself afterwards, because if you fuel properly, you can do whatever you ask of your body, or your body will do what you ask of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to push through insane pain. I had a terrible knee pain, similar to what I've been dealing with now. And it was like, I mean, I actually took ibuprofen. I never take medicine. I'm not a medicine person, but mm-hmm. I bring it with me just in case. And I had to take it the last day because I was in so much pain, but I was like, I can't get to the second line or to the finish line second. I've already done that. I've already been there.
Yeah.
First is the only way. So I pushed past a lot of pain. And then I finished and I was so proud of myself. Yeah. So yeah, I don't, it's just the pain is secondary.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. And then it expands what you know you can do for the next time.
Yeah, I always talk about it like a filing cabinet. Mm. You know, you've got a filing cabinet full of experiences, and you can look back when you're in something and you can think, shit, I've been through something way worse than this.
Yeah.
You know?
Totally. That's interesting. Do you have any more stories from Atlas? Like, are there any other stories that come to mind?
The tea experience actually is kind of cool. Yeah. So after Atlas, I'm on the four and a half days. It took me 4 days, 19 hours. So I'm on the morning before finishing. And at this point, I'm 60K ahead of the next place woman. And so in my mind, and this is something I struggle with, is like once I'm like far enough ahead, I can get a little lazy. So I was struggling through the night, actually. That was I had a pretty low moment. I was climbing up what they call the Moroccan Stelvio. And there's so many switchbacks, like never ending. But it was dark and I was pretty sleep deprived at that point. And I started almost having a panic attack. I hadn't really had one of these before while racing. And I wanted to take a nap. I can take like a 5 to 7 minute nap. If I just lay down on the side of the road, I'll fall asleep. And then it's kind of like when you're driving, you start to fall asleep while you're driving and you're like, oh, just pull over and take a short nap. It's similar, and I can keep going then for a couple hours, and then I could take another nap if I need. That's kind of what the shorter racing style of sleeping I utilize. But this time, I felt like there was not a safe place to sleep, to like take a full sleep or a nap.
What do you mean? Like it, just the terrain was dicey?
Yeah, it was the switchback thing, and there was no guardrail, and I just felt unsafe. And there was, on the inside of the mountain, there was like a drainage ditch, so it was like not really a place I could sleep. And then there was no pull off or anything, and I'm sure if I was to go there during the day, it would be fine. I would have been able to find a place, but I was so sleep deprived, I started panicking, and I almost went into a panic attack. I'd never experienced something like this before, And I just had to sit on the side of the road and like basically will myself to meditate, which I also had not had to do before.
Wow.
So my heart rate was like mega high. I sat and I just kind of like did some breathing exercises and kind of composed myself. And then I was able to get back on my bike without panicking and ride until I was able to find a spot maybe like 20 minutes later on the other side of the, I finally got to the top of the climb. I mean, I think it took me 2 hours. It was so long.
Yeah.
And then I was like, you know, in the middle of nowhere, found a spot, fell asleep, which was good because I really needed to sleep at that point. Slept for 2 hours, rode through the night more. But the morning, I found a place to resupply for the first time in a while, like 12 hours at that point. And when I got there, the media team following the women's race was there. And so he was filming me in the resupply location. It was like a small store, kind of like a hallway style. And I kind of was, you know, getting some stuff. And because the guy was taking pictures of me, I think the shopkeeper was like, oh, this person seems important. Do you want to have tea?
What?
I don't, I was like, sure. You know, tea there is very, like, it's a ceremony. They do this whole thing.
Oh my goodness. This is amazing.
But he invites me to sit in the back of the shop to have tea, and there was someone outside he also invited in, must have been a friend. And
you're just on death's doorstep meanwhile.
Yes, and I'm ready to be done, but they do the tea ceremony and bring out fresh bread. They have bread there, bread's everywhere, but this was like the most amazing fresh bread I've ever had in my entire life. Oh, wow. It was next level delicious. It was like they don't put that stuff out, they kind of keep that for themselves or something, I
interesting.
Guess. Because I had bought some bread 5 seconds before and it was like a rock, and then he brought out new fresh bread for me, and
Moroccans are holding out on us.
They were holding out on it. It was such a wonderful experience, and I didn't speak French, he didn't speak English. We just kind of like enjoyed each other's company. He asked me for a selfie. We took a selfie together. It was really cool. I bought an apple while I was there though, and when I left, put it in my pocket. It was the only produce I had seen on the whole route.
Oh, wow.
And I rode for 5 minutes and like had to adjust something in my bag. I stopped and two donkeys came up to me. And I thought, you know what?
I remember this video.
I'm going to take this apple out and see if they will eat the apple. And one of the donkeys basically ate the entire apple. Like he ate around it. I held it and like spun it for him so that he could eat it. Oh.
This is sort of a weird observation. But one thing I think I really appreciate about following ultra racing is that because of how connected we are these days and the media around them or the social media posts that you might make, little moments like that, like feeding an apple to a donkey, like the apple and that moment takes on greater meaning because it becomes a part of the story of the race.
Mm-hmm.
Or the tea visit. Like, I can't remember if there were photos and video around that, but these little like human moments or moments where the race kind of stops.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're at least for me, I don't know about others, but for me, it's a nice reminder to not forget about moments like that day to day. Because I don't know, in this day and age, it feels like it's easy to forget to take the time to do little things like that. Say yes to a stranger asking you to tea or stop to feed the donkey an apple, you know? Those are little things that it sounds so simple, but you can derive such a special little moment out of times like that, I feel like.
Yeah, agreed. And I also, for me, that's why I want to race ultras. I look back and I think that's what I remember. Granted, I won the race. That's amazing. And I'm competitive. And if I hadn't won, I would have to go back and do it again. But I can look back now and be satisfied on a whole multitude of levels because I did get to experience Morocco in a very special way before the race, after the race, during the race. And I also had the competitive side. And for me, it, you know, checks all of those boxes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. So before we get kicked out of the sound room, I do want to talk about, because you mentioned it before we started recording, like we've talked a lot about your motivations and what it's like to be in these races and all that sort of thing. But you've also recently started this journey of making it a career. Talk to me about that. Like, how have those pieces come together? Because there is no playbook, even for the more, like, I don't know, like we mentioned the Grand Prix, even for that, like there's not even close to being a playbook of how you make that a career. Talk to me about how you've found yourself here and how you think you want to take that opportunity.
I never thought that I could do cycling as my job. I always said, if I get a bike, I'll feel like a professional cyclist. And then I finally got a bike and I was like, nah, this doesn't count. And then I said, you know, if I make money from it, then I'll feel like a professional cyclist. So this year I'm making money from bike brands, non-bike brands, to support me for racing. So I can say that I'm a professional cyclist. I have this, I don't know, feeling of, it feels weird to say that because part of me doesn't feel like I deserve it. I'm sort of a self-doubter in that way.
Yep.
But I'm growing to be more confident and I'm proud of the work that I've done to get here. It's really been a long journey. I've been racing bikes for a while for fun, for competition. And I realized that I was pretty good at these ultras. And granted, the fields are small. So I'm over here self-doubting again, but the fields are smaller. But I'm out there competing and I'm beating the men. So I have this feeling of confidence that I do deserve to make it my job. And I'm owning that space. I'm learning to own that space. And I actually had no idea if it was going to work out. I, you know, going into the fall, my life in the last year has kind of blown up. I got divorced. I moved. And I decided I would become a professional cyclist all in 1 year. And it's been a roller coaster of emotions. And it wasn't until, I mean, as you know, contracts and things like that, you don't know that stuff. It takes a while. Brands take their sweet time. They've got, you know, they've got their budgets and their this and their that. Yeah, so figuring that out at the end of the year was like a huge relief. Because it was like, well, it's either this or I have to focus on the other 5,000 things I do, which is like wedding videography. I put on a gravel race. So this allows me to be able to continue racing and traveling and focusing on it like full time. Yeah. And working with Dennis at the Orange Seal Academy has been really good because I'm really treating it like seriously. It's my you know, training is the number one thing, and then all the other stuff, but there's a lot of other stuff too.
yeah
As we talked before we got on the podcast, it's like, you know, you're riding your bike, but there's 700 other things that you need to be doing.
You're an entrepreneur.
And
speaking of, let's talk about the other things you have going on. So you have a podcast now. And you have this race, Gravista. What do you, I guess let's take one at a time. Talk to me about the podcast. How did that come about? And what do you focus on? What do you talk about?
It's called Detours. And the podcast actually was the brainchild of my friend Mel Webb. She is wonderful, is an ultra cyclist as well, was at Atlas, and wanted to do a podcast, wanted to have me as a guest originally. But we became friends in the last year, and somehow we were like, well, maybe we should just be co-hosts because podcasts are fun when there's two people and I have my connection, she has hers, and I think our dynamic was pretty good. So we have, you know, a plethora of guests that are very different from race organizers, all in the ultra field, all like kind of world. We do dabble in some other, we're interviewing Sarah Sturm this week, which is fun. Cool. Yeah, love Sarah. So our main focus is women because there's not enough coverage about women. And then just anybody doing cool stuff in the ultra world. And then Gravista, I started it in I started it the year the pandemic happened. Like, I was planning it and I had to cancel. It's in Buena Vista, Virginia, and 65 miles, 8,500 feet for the long one. Yeah, dang. It's a challenging one. And then 30 miles and 4,500 feet. Goes in the Blue Ridge Mountains. Super beautiful, super challenging, Forest Service roads. There's you kind of ride on the Blue Ridge Parkway, actually, for a little bit of it.
Cool.
So, yeah, this will be the fourth year.
Why did you decide to do that? I'm so good. Because there's a lot of things that I'm interested in doing as an entrepreneur, but putting on a race is so intimidating. Like, I would not pick that, personally.
I had that year was my, like, kind of, like, first blow up of my life. Like, I left the job I had been working for a while, and I knew I wanted to be my own boss, and putting on a bike race seemed like it's fine, maybe I'll try it. It felt really safe, my situation there. All of the ways of putting the race on seemed like easy. I had, like, it's small town vibes, and like, I just, it all kind of came together. And I had help from friends and I learned from friends and it just felt like, you know what, I'm going to try it. Why not? It's not like I make a ton of money on it. It's a labor of love. People don't realize the amount of money it takes to put a race on.
Yep.
But I really started it because where I lived in Virginia is my favorite place ever to ride. It's so beautiful. You can go and ride on roads forever. It's really approachable. Feels, you know, the 4,000 feet is like the highest, you know, you can get up there. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's where I learned to ride gravel. And I felt like I wanted to share that with everybody.
Yeah.
So
that feeling, I totally understand.
Yeah.
Absolutely. When is it?
May 11th this year. Yep.
And where can people check out registration and stuff?
So we're on Bike Reg. The website's also just ridegravista.com. Mm-hmm. So you can find it. We're on social media too. So yeah, it's a small race. I think hopefully maybe we'll have 250 or 300 people this year.
It's pretty good.
You know, it is, but there's a break even number often on races and I have to have at least 200 people. Yeah. Otherwise I lose money.
Yeah. So, all right, listeners, if you want to gravel race up in May,
mm-hmm.
Very cool. And I think it would be fun to shout out the people who are supporting you too, making this all possible. So you have 3T, Orange Seal.
Yeah. Also working with Apadura for bags.
Cool.
Started working with, Bevo Bottles, Schwalbe Tires, Velocio Clothing. Amazing. Nice. Super helpful for racing. With the Fly Free Bibs as a woman. Love their clothes. The Whitewater of Charlotte. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, but
funny you mentioned that. I was supposed to be there this past weekend.
What? Wait,
this weekend.
No way.
Yesterday. They have a partnership with Red Bull and they have a race called the Whole Enchilada.
The Whole Enchilada. Yeah. I was going to be here, but that was one of the races I was considering doing. So
it was postponed.
Was it?
Yeah.
Oh, no way.
Until April something. Oh. Yeah.
Hmm.
Anyway,
I'll be there.
So they
sponsor
you.
Yeah.
That is cool.
Yeah. The marketing director there is a bike packer.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. We connected on a bike packing trip.
Very cool.
So that's a cool partnership. Yeah. We're doing a film screening of that Badlands film in April.
Nice.
Before I head to Traca.
Yeah.
And then let's see, POC for helmet and eyewear. You know, you always forget when you're put on the spot.
I know, I'm sorry. Do you have a website?
Yeah. It's wattwagon.cc.
Wattwagon.
I know the Wattwagon.
Wattwagon. I remember that.
Oh, God.
Such a legendary IG handle.
Everyone just calls me Wagon or, you know, I don't know. So my name is Cynthia, but you can also call me Wattwagon if you feel the need to.
So good.
Yep.
Cool. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, you do have somewhere to be soon, so we should wrap this up, but... we have a lot more to talk about, so maybe after Traca we do another one of these.
Are you racing the Traca?
The 200.
Only the 200?
Wow, you're so disgusted.
Not the 350? Wait, does the 200 count for which one is it? Are you considering like Gravel Earth Series at all, or you're just
not really?
No, okay.
I mean, if something magic happens and I accidentally win Traca and then like want to go. Do
the Grand Prix.
Oregon Trail, then maybe I'll keep one eye on it. Uh-huh. But there's no way you can do both.
No,
I don't think.
No, with the Grand Prix, and no, that's
yeah. No. I'm curious. It's amazing that we have so much to choose from at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
Yeah, 200. I mean, the 200 is the most competitive, and it's also the one that for me makes sense 1 month out from Unbound. I think like a 13-hour race and then another race between Unbound, which is because I'm going to do Rule of Three.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I think it would just be a little bit of a roll of the dice.
Yeah.
But one of these days.
Mm-hmm.
And even the 200 is a beast of a course. Like, Classmark is not messing around.
I'm so excited.
Shit.
I'm very excited. That's my favorite kind of racing, that style of like long, lots of climbing.
Yeah.
And lots of technical riding too.
Yeah.
Over there. So, well, cool.
Sweet. Thanks, mm-hmm. Cynthia. This was fun.
Yeah, thank you.
We didn't talk about Bentonville at all.
But we didn't need to.
We'll do it.
We'll do it on another pod.
Okay. Yes.
Sounds good.
Talk to you later. Hello again, everyone. Thank you so much for listening today. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Cynthia Carson. As a reminder, I'm off to pick up Nicole from the airport here in a few minutes. And if you'd like to participate in the episode that we'll be recording in the next few days about her 3 weeks there, working on so many projects. I mean, the number of things that she's doing all at once just kind of boggles my mind. I have trouble keeping up with it, and I live with her. So we figured it was high time that you heard from her directly. For those of you that follow her, for those of you that are interested or inspired in inspired by what she does. So please send us your questions. Feel free to send her a message on Instagram or me, or email the podcast at theadventurestash.com. Also, thank you, Dometic, for supporting today's episode. It's a new year. Dometic is still here supporting. We have a new discount code for you, 15% off site-wide, not just the outdoor category now. The code is PAYSON15 at checkout at dometic.com. If you're like me, we're starting to gear up for some spring activities, both racing-oriented and more recreational. Maybe you need some camping chairs. Maybe you need a powered cooler, some drinkware, whatever it may be. You can find it at dometic.com. Be sure to use code PAYSON15 at checkout for 15% off anything site-wide. Lastly, I mentioned at the top of the show, there's a new YouTube video up on my channel, the Santovai Gravel Stage 1, which is the Gravel Earth series. First race of my year back in February, back in Girona. Really unique race format. Only 17-minute video, but lots happens. I found myself running out of time rather than running out of things to say. We had a data overlay on that one as well, per a lot of feedback we got from people wanting power numbers, heart rate, speed, percent grade, which is relevant to this one because there was upwards of a 20% section towards the top. Anyway, another fun video for everyone that enjoyed the one from Mid-South. You can go to the YouTube channel and check out the next one. And I'll be recording another from Santovai Gravel Stage 2 in the next few days. Lastly, thank you, Lily McKelvin, a.k.a. Lily Hardman, for supporting, as always, with her incredible editing. She had a little bit of extra work today with the static on one of the mics. Things like this happen, and she does an incredible job of minimizing the damage. And then when things go smoothly, she does an amazing job of just making it sound excellent. There's a lot more that goes into these episodes editing-wise than you might guess. So big thanks to her for always supporting. And thanks to Nicole for producing the show. Somehow she continued to manage to help produce the show even while she was working on Path of Logic the last 3 weeks over in Uganda. Craziness. As always, you can go to the Instagram account, The Adventure Stash, to play our Friday quizzes for your chance to win some custom socks. And that should do it. Thank you all so much for listening. We'll catch you next week.